boy study. I think of how Virgil would do this if he were trying to get information from a suspect. No, I was a baby. I guess I slept through most of it. I stare at him. Do you?
Unfortunately, yes. I wish I could forget.
We are almost in town by now. The ribbon of residences whizzing by starts to give way to box stores and gas stations. Why? I blurt out. Because you were the one who killed her? Gideon swerves, braking. He looks like I've slapped him across the face.
Jenna, I loved your mother,
he swears.
I was trying to protect her. I wanted to marry her. I wanted to take care of you and the baby.
All the air in the car is gone. Just like that. It's like a seal of plastic has been placed over my nose and mouth. Maybe I've heard him wrong. Maybe he said he would have taken care of me, the baby. Except he didn't. Gideon slows the car to a stop and looks into his lap.
You didn't know,
he murmurs. In one move, I press down on my seatbelt latch and open the passenger door. I start to run. I can hear the door slam behind me. It's Gideon, coming after me. I enter the first building I can find, a diner, and run past the hostess to the back, where the restrooms usually are. In the ladies' room, I lock the door, climb onto the sink, and slide open the narrow window cut into the wall beside it. I can hear voices outside the ladies' room, Gideon begging someone to come in and get me. I shimmy through the window, drop down on the lid of the closed dumpster in the alley behind the diner, and bolt. I race through the woods. I don't stop until I'm on the outskirts of town. Then, for the first time in a day and a half, I turn on my cell phone. I have a signal. 3 bars. I have 43 messages from my grandmother, but I ignore them and dial Serenity's number. She picks up on the third ring, and I'm so grateful I burst into tears. Please, I say. I need help.
Alice. Sitting in the attic of the African barn, I wondered, not for the first time, if I was the one who was crazy. By then, Thomas had been home for 5 months. Gideon had painted over the walls again. There were drop cloths on the floor and cans of paint lining the edges, but otherwise, the space was empty. No evidence remained of the break from reality that had swallowed my husband whole. At times, I was able to convince myself that I had imagined the entire episode. It was pouring today. Jenna had been so excited to leave for school in her new rubber boots, which were fashioned to look like ladybugs. They had been a gift from Grace and Gideon for her second birthday. Because of the weather, the elephants had chosen to stay in their barns. Nevi and Grace were folding and stuffing envelopes for a fundraising campaign. Thomas was on his way home from New York City, where he'd been meeting with officials from Tusk. Thomas never told me where he'd gone for treatment, just that it wasn't in this state, and he had driven there when he realized that the first center he'd planned on checking into was now closed. I didn't know whether or not to believe him, but he seemed like himself again, and if I had doubts, I kept them quiet. I did not ask to see the books or to second-guess him. The last time I had done that, I'd nearly been strangled. He had come back from his recuperation with new medication and with checks from 3 private investors. Had they been inpatients too? I wondered, but I didn't really care, as long as their checks didn't bounce. He took over the reins of running the sanctuary as if he'd never left. But if that transition was flawless, his reintegration into our marriage was not. Although he hadn't had a manic or a depressive episode for months, I still could not trust him, and he knew it. We were circles in a Venn diagram, Jenna caught at our overlap. Now, when he spent long hours in his office, I couldn't help but wonder if he was hiding gibberish like he'd written before. When I asked him if he felt stable, he accused me of turning on him and started locking the door. It was a vicious cycle. I dreamed about leaving, taking Jenna and running away. I would pick her up at preschool and just keep driving. Sometimes I was even brave enough to say it out loud when Gideon and I found time to be together. I didn't do it, though, because I suspected Thomas knew I was sleeping with Gideon, and I didn't know which a court would find better equipped to parent, the father with a mental illness or the mother who had betrayed him. It had been months since Thomas and I had slept together. I would pour my glass of wine at 7:30, just after Jenna had been put to bed, and would read on the couch until I fell asleep. My interactions with him were limited to polite conversation in front of Jenna when she was awake, and heated arguments while she slept. I still took Jenna into the enclosures with me. After her close call as a baby, she had learned her lesson. And how could a child grow up in an elephant sanctuary without feeling comfortable around elephants? Thomas still thought this was an accident waiting to happen, when in reality, I was more afraid of my daughter being left alone with him. One night, after I'd taken Jenna with me inside the fences again, he grabbed my arms so hard that bruises formed.
"What judge would think of you as a fit mother?"
he hissed. Suddenly, I realized he wasn't just talking about Jenna in the enclosures, and that I wasn't the only one thinking of sole custody. It was Grace who suggested that maybe it was time for Jenna to go to a preschool program. She was nearly 2 and a half now, and the only social interaction she had came from adults and elephants. I seized on the idea because it would give me 3 hours a day when I didn't have to worry about Jenna being left with Thomas. If you had asked me who I was then, I could not have told you. The mother who dropped Jenna off in town with a lunchbox full of carrots and sliced apples? The researcher who submitted her paper on Mora's grief to academic journals, praying over each file before pushing the send button? The wife in a little black dress who stood beside Thomas at a Boston cocktail party, clapping enthusiastically when he took the microphone to talk about elephant conservation. The woman who bloomed in the arms of a lover, as if he were the only sunlight left in the world to feed her. 3/4 of my life, I felt like I was playing a role, like I could walk off stage and stop pretending. And the minute I was out of the public eye, I wanted to be with Gideon. I was a liar. I was hurting people who did not even know they were being hurt, and I still was not strong enough to stop myself. But an elephant sanctuary is a very busy place with very little privacy, particularly when you are having an affair and both of your spouses work there too. There were a few frantic couplings in the outdoors, and one so sudden behind the door of the Asian barn that we'd played Russian roulette, forgoing protection for the mercy of each other's bodies. So perhaps it wasn't irony, just desperation, that led me to find a secure, secluded place for our trysts, a spot that Thomas would never venture and that Nevi and Grace would never think to look. The door opened, and like always, my breath caught, just in case. Gideon stood in a downpour, twisting an umbrella so that it pinched shut. He left it propped against the metal railing of the spiral staircase and stepped into the room. I had spread a drop cloth on the floor while I was waiting for him.
"It's a monsoon out there," Gideon huffed.
I stood up and began to unbutton his shirt. "Then we ought to get you out of these wet clothes," I said.
"How long?"
he asked. 20 minutes, I said. It was as long as I thought I could disappear and not be missed. To his credit, Gideon never complained and never tried to keep me. We moved inside the parameters of our fences. Even a little freedom was better than none. I pressed up against him, resting my head on his chest. I closed my eyes as he kissed me, lifting me so that I could wrap my legs around him. Over his shoulder, through the sheer plastic that had never been replaced, I watched the rain stream down in sheets, a cleansing. I don't really know how long Grace was standing in the doorway at the top of the stairs, watching us, holding her umbrella down so that it did no good at all to shield her from the storm. The phone call had come from Jenna's school. She was running a fever. She'd thrown up. Could someone come get her? Grace would have gone herself, but she thought I'd want to know. She could not find me in the African barn, which was where I'd told her I was headed. She saw Gideon's red umbrella. Maybe, she thought, he'd know where I was. I sobbed. I apologized. I begged her to forgive Gideon, not to tell Thomas. I gave Gideon back. And I retreated into my research again, because I could not work with any of them. Nevi would not speak to me. Grace couldn't, without dissolving into tears. And Gideon knew better. I held my breath, expecting them to give Thomas their notice any day, and then I realized they wouldn't. Where else would the three of them find jobs taking care of elephants together? This was their home, maybe more than it ever had been mine. I began to plan my escape. I'd read stories about parents who kidnapped their own children, who dyed their hair and spirited them across borders with fake IDs and new names. Jenna was young enough to grow up with only the faintest memories of this life. And I could find something else to do. I would never publish again. I couldn't without risking being found by Thomas, who would then take Jenna away from me. But if anonymity kept us safe, wasn't it worth it? I went so far as to pack a duffel with Jenna's clothing and mine, and to hold back a few dollars here and there until I had a couple hundred tucked into the lining of my computer sleeve. That, I hoped, was enough to buy us a start on a new life. On the morning that I intended to make our escape, I had run through the steps in my mind 1,000 times. I would dress Jenna in her favorite overalls and her pink sneakers. I would feed her a waffle, her favorite, cut into sticks so that she could dip it in maple syrup. I would let her pick one stuffed animal to take in the car with her to school, like usual. But we would not go to school. We would just pass the building and get on the highway and be long gone before anyone thought to question it. I had run through the steps in my mind 1,000 times, but that was before Gideon burst into the cottage, clutching a note in his hand, asking me if I'd seen Grace, his eyes begging for the answer to be yes. She had written it by hand. She said by the time he found this, it would be too late. The note, I later found out, was waiting in the bathroom on the counter when Gideon woke up. It was weighed down with a cairn of stones, a small and perfect pyramid. Maybe even the same kind that Grace had stuffed in her pockets before she lay herself down on the bottom of the Connecticut River, not 2 miles from the spot where her husband was fast asleep.
Serenity. Poltergeist is one of those German words, like Zeitgeist or Schadenfreude, that everyone thinks they know, but no one really understands. The translation is noisy ghost, and it's legitimate. They are the loud bullies of the psychic world. They have a tendency to attach themselves to teenage girls who dabble in the occult or who have wild mood swings, both of which attract angry energy. I used to tell my clients that poltergeists are just plain pissed off. They're often the ghosts of women who were wronged, or men who were betrayed, people who never got a chance to fight back. That frustration manifests itself in biting or pinching the inhabitants of a house, cupboards banging, or doors slamming, dishes whizzing across a room, and shutters opening and closing. In some cases, too, there is a connection to one of the elements. Spontaneous winds that blow paintings off walls, fires that break out on the carpets, or a deluge of water. Virgil wipes his eyes with the tail of his shirt, trying to take this all in.
So you think we were just chased out of that house by a ghost?
A poltergeist, I say, but why split hairs?
And you think it's Grace?
It makes sense. She drowned herself because her husband was cheating on her. If anyone's going to come back and haunt as a water poltergeist, it would be her. Virgil nods, considering that.
Nevi seemed to think her daughter was still alive.
Actually, I point out, Nevi said her daughter would be back soon. She didn't specify in what form.
Even if I wasn't completely wiped out from pulling an all-nighter, this would be hard for me to wrap my head around, Virgil admits. I'm used to hard evidence.
I reach over and grasp the edge of his shirt, wring it out on the ground.
Yeah, I say sarcastically. I guess this doesn't count as hard evidence. So Gideon fakes Nevi's death, and she winds up in Tennessee. In a house that belonged to her daughter at some point.
He shakes his head.
Why?
I can't answer that. But I don't have to, because my phone starts to ring. I rummage in my purse and finally locate it. I know that number.
Please, Jenna says. I need help. Slow down, Virgil says for the fifth time.
She swallows, but her eyes are red from crying, and her nose is still running. I rummage in my bag for a tissue and can find only a lens cloth for cleaning sunglasses. I offer her that instead. The directions she gave us were a teenager's directions.
You pass a Walmart, and somewhere there's a left, and a Waffle House. I'm pretty sure the turn is after the Waffle House.
Honestly, it's a miracle that we managed to find her at all. When we did, she was behind a service station's chain-link fence and dumpster, halfway up a tree.
Jenna, goddammit, where are you?
Virgil yelled, and only after she heard his voice did her face poke through the branches and the leaves, a small moon in a green field of stars. She climbed gingerly down the trunk, until she lost her footing and fell into Virgil's arms.
I've got you, he told her.
He hasn't let go of her yet.
I found Gideon,
Jenna says, her voice hitched and uneven.
Where? At the sanctuary.
She starts crying again.
At first, I started to think that maybe he hurt my mom, she says.
And I see Virgil's fingers flex on her shoulders.
Did he touch you?
Virgil asks. I am thoroughly convinced that if Jenna gives a positive response, Virgil would kill Gideon with his bare hands. She shakes her head.
It was just a feeling.
Good thing you listened to your gut, sugar, I say.
But he said he never saw my mother. After the night she was taken to the hospital.
Virgil presses his lips together.
He could be lying through his teeth.
Jenna's eyes fill again. It makes me think of Nevi and the room that would not stop weeping.
He said my mom was having a baby. His baby.
I know my psychic powers are a little off, I murmur, but I did not see that coming. Virgil lets go of Jenna and starts pacing. That's motive, he starts muttering, working through a timeline in his head. I watch him tick off points on his fingers, shake his head, start over, and finally, grimly, turn to her. There's something you need to know. While you were with Gideon in the sanctuary, Serenity and I were with Nevi Rule. Her head snaps up.
Nevi Rule's dead!
No, Virgil corrects. Someone wanted us to think Nevi Rule was dead.
My father?
Your dad wasn't the one who found the trampled body. That was Gideon. He was sitting with her when the medical examiner and the cops arrived. She wipes her eyes.
But there was still a body.
I look down at the ground, waiting for Jenna to connect the dots. When she does, the arrow points in a different direction than I expect.
Gideon didn't do it, she insists. I thought that too, at first. But she was pregnant.
Virgil takes a step forward.
Exactly, he says. That's why Gideon wasn't the one to kill her.
Before we leave, Virgil goes to use the restroom at the service station, and Jenna and I are left alone. Her eyes are still bloodshot.
If my mom is dead,
she lets her voice trail off.
Could she wait for me?
People like to think that they can reunite with a loved one who's passed, but there are so many layers to the afterlife. It's like saying that you're bound to run into someone because you both live on planet Earth. However, I think Jenna's had enough bad news for one day. Sugar, she might be here with you right now.
I don't get it.
The spirit world is modeled on the real world and the real things we've seen. You might go into your grandmother's kitchen, and she'll be down there making coffee. You may be making your bed, and she walks by the open door. But every now and then, the edges will blur, because you're inhabiting the same space. You're like oil and vinegar in the same container.
So, she says, her voice cracking, I don't ever really get her back.
I could lie to her. I could tell her what everyone wants to hear, but I won't.
No,
I tell Jenna. You don't.
And what happens to my dad?
I can't answer that for her. I don't know if Virgil will try to prove that Thomas was the one who killed his wife that night, or if it would even stick, given the poor man's mental state. Jenna sits on the picnic table and draws her knees up to her chest.
I had this friend once, Chatham, who always talked about Paris like it was practically heaven. She wanted to go to the Sorbonne for college. She was going to stroll down the Champs-Élysées. She was going to sit at a cafe and watch skinny French women walking down the street, all that stuff.
Her aunt surprised her by taking her there on a business trip when she was 12. When Chatham came home, I asked her if it was all it was cracked up to be, and you know what she said?
It was kind of like any other city.
Jenna shrugs.
I didn't think it would feel like this when I got here.
To Tennessee?
No, to the end, I guess.
She looks up at me, her eyes brimming with tears.
Just because I know now that she didn't want to leave me behind doesn't make it easier, you know. Nothing's changed. She's not here. I am. And I still feel empty.
I slide an arm around her. It's no small feat, finishing a journey, I tell her. But no one ever mentions that once you get there, you still have to turn around and head all the way home. Jenna dashes her hand across her eyes.
If it turns out Virgil is right, I want to see my dad before he goes to jail.
We don't know that he'll...
It wasn't his fault. He didn't know what he was doing.
She says this with such conviction
that I realize it isn't necessarily what she believes, just what she needs to. I pull her closer and let her cry for a little while against my shoulder.
Serenity?
Jenna asks, her voice muffled against my shirt.
Will you let me talk to her whenever I need to?
There's a reason people are dead. Back when I could be a medium, I'd only do 2 spirit communications at most for a client. I wanted to help people through their grief, not be 1-800-DIAL-THE-DEAD. When I was good at this, when I had Lucinda and Desmond to protect me from the spirits that needed me to do their bidding, I knew how to put up walls. That's what kept me from being awakened in the middle of the night by a conga line of spirits who needed to get a message to the living. It let me use my gift on my terms instead of theirs. Now, though, I would trade my privacy if it meant that I could connect with spirits again. I would never do a fake reading for Jenna. She deserves better than that. So there's no way I could possibly give her what she wants. But all the same, I look her in the eye and say, "Of course." Suffice it to say that the trip home is long, hellish, and silent. We wouldn't be able to get on a plane without permission from Jenna's guardian because she's a minor, so we wind up driving through the night. I listen to the radio to keep myself awake, and then Virgil starts talking, somewhere around the Maryland border. He glances back first, to make sure Jenna is still fast asleep.
"Say she's dead," Virgil says. "What do I do?"
It's a surprise conversation starter. "You mean Alice?"
"Yeah."
I hesitate. "I guess you figure out for sure who did it, and you go after them."
"I'm not a cop, Serenity. And now it turns out that I probably never should have been."
He shakes his head.
"All this time I thought it was Donnie who fucked up. But it turns out it was me."
I glance at him.
"I mean, it was a clusterfuck at the sanctuary that day. No one knew how to secure a crime scene when there were wild animals roaming around. Thomas Metcalf was off his gourd, although we didn't know it at first. There were missing people who hadn't been reported as missing. One of them was an adult female. That's all I was looking for. So I made an assumption. When I found an unconscious body that was dirty and covered with blood, I told the paramedics that it was Alice, and they took her off to the hospital and admitted her under that name."
He turns, looking out the window, so that his profile is traced by the passing headlights of other cars.
"She didn't have ID. I should have followed up. Why can't I remember what she looked like when I saw her? Was the hair blonde or red? Why didn't I pay attention?"
"Because you were focused on getting her medical attention," I say. "Don't beat yourself up. You didn't try to mislead anyone," I point out, thinking of my own recent career as a swamp witch.
"That,"
he says,
"is where you're wrong."
He turns to me.
"I buried evidence. That red hair that was found on Nevi's body, when I saw it in the ME's report, I didn't know it belonged to Alice. But I did know it meant the case was more than an accidental death. Still, I let my partner convince me that the public just wanted to feel safe, that a trampling was bad enough, but a murder would be even worse. So I made that page of the ME's report disappear. And just like Donnie had said, I became a hero. I was the youngest guy to get promoted to detective. Did you know that?" He shakes his head.
"What did you do with the page?"
"I put it into my pocket the morning of my detective ceremony. And then I got into my car and drove over a cliff."
I jam on the brakes.
"You did what?"
"First responders thought I was a goner. I guess I flatlined. But apparently I managed to fuck that up, too.
because I woke up in rehab with a shitload of OxyContin in my veins and enough pain to kill 10 men who were way stronger than me. Needless to say, I didn't go back to the job. IA doesn't look too kindly on guys who have a death wish. He looks at me. So now you know who I really am. I couldn't stand the thought of pretending to be the good guy for the next 20 years when I knew I wasn't one. At least now, when I tell people I'm an alcoholic loser, I'm not lying to them. I think of Jenna, hiring a fraud of a psychic and an investigator with secrets of his own. I think of all the mounting evidence that Alice Metcalf is the body that was recovered from the sanctuary 10 years ago, and how not once was I able to sense that. I have to tell you something, too, I confess. Remember how you kept asking me if I could communicate with Alice Metcalf's spirit, and I said no, which probably meant she wasn't dead?
Yeah, guess your gift might need recalibrating.
It needs more than that. I haven't had a syllable of psychic communication since I gave Senator McCoy the wrong information about his son. I am used up, done, dry. This stick shift has more paranormal talent than I do. Virgil starts to laugh.
You're telling me you are a hack?
It's worse, because I wasn't always. I look at him. There is a green mask around his eyes, a reflection from the mirror, as if he is some kind of Superman. But he isn't. He's flawed and scarred and battle-weary, just like me, just like all of us. Jenna lost her mother. I lost my credibility. Virgil lost his faith. We've all got missing pieces. But for a little while, I believed that, together, we might be whole. We cross into Delaware. I don't think she could have picked two worse people to help her if she tried, I sigh.
That's all the more reason, Virgil says, to make it right.
Alice. I did not go to Georgia for Grace's funeral. She was buried in a family plot beside her father. Gideon went, and Nevi, of course. But the reality of running an animal sanctuary meant someone had to stay behind to take care of the animals, no matter how pressing the reason to leave. In the horrible week that it had taken for Grace's body to wash ashore, a week when Gideon and Nevi still held out hope that she was alive somewhere, we had all been pitching in to cover for her. Thomas would interview for a new caregiver, but that wasn't a hire that could be made quickly. And now, with our staff below half capacity, it meant that Thomas and I were working round the clock. When Thomas told me that Gideon had come back to the sanctuary after the funeral, I was not presumptuous enough to believe that he had returned because of me. I did not know, really, what to expect. We'd had a year of secrets, a year of bliss. What had happened to Grace was the punishment, the payment due. Except nothing had happened to Grace. Grace had been the one to make it happen. I did not want to think about that. So instead, I buried myself in cleaning the barns until the floors were sparkling, in creating new enrichment toys for the Asian elephants. I cut back the brush that had begun to overgrow the fence at the north end of the African enclosure. That would have been Gideon's job, I thought, even as I wielded the hedge trimmers. I kept myself moving so that I could not think about anything except the task in front of me. I did not see Gideon until the next morning, when he was driving an ATV with a load of hay into the same barn where I was making medicine balls out of apples for that day's feeding. I dropped the knife and ran to the doorway, my hand raised to call him closer, but at the last minute, I stepped back into the shadows. Really, What could I possibly say to him? I watched for a few minutes as he unloaded the hay, his arms flexing as he stacked the bales into a pyramid. Finally, gathering my courage, I stepped out into the sunshine. He paused, then set down the bale he had been holding. "Sira's limping again," I said. "If you get a chance, can you take a look?" He nodded, not meeting my gaze.
"What else do you need me to do?"
"The air conditioner in the office is broken, but it's not a priority." I crossed my arms tightly. "I'm so sorry, Gideon." Gideon kicked the hay, creating a haze of dust between us. He looked at me for the first time since I'd approached. His eyes were so bloodshot that it looked as if something had burst inside him. I thought maybe it was shame. I reached out, but he ducked so that my fingers only grazed him. Then he turned his back on me and grabbed another bale of hay. I blinked at the sun in my eyes as I returned to the kitchen in the barn. To my shock, Nevi stood in the spot I'd been minutes before, using a spoon to scoop peanut butter into the apples I had cored. Neither Thomas nor I had expected Nevi to return any time soon. After all, she had just buried her child. "Nevi, you're back?" She did not look up at me as she worked.
"Where else would I be?"
she said. A few days later, I lost my own daughter. We were in the cottage, and Jenna was crying because she did not want to lie down and rest. Lately, she had been afraid to fall asleep. Instead of a nap, Jenna called it the leaving time. She was certain that if she closed her eyes, I would not be here again when she opened them, and no matter what I did or said to convince her otherwise, she sobbed and fought her exhaustion until her body triumphed over her will. I tried singing to her, rocking her. I folded dollar bills into origami elephants, which usually distracted her enough to stop the crying. She finally drifted off the only way she could these days, with my body curled around hers like a snail's shell, a protective home. I had just extricated myself from that position when Gideon knocked at the door. He needed help erecting a hot wire fence so that he could regrade parts of the African enclosure. The elephants liked to dig for fresh water, but the holes they created were dangerous to the elephants themselves and to us on our ATVs and on foot. You could fall into one and snap your leg or strike your head. You could break an axle on your vehicle. Hot wire was a two-person job, particularly with the African elephants. One of us would have to string the fence while the other pushed the animals back with a vehicle. I was reluctant to go with him for two reasons. I didn't want Jenna to wake up and have her worst fear that I was indeed gone realized, and I didn't know where my relationship with Gideon stood right now. "Get Thomas," I suggested.
"He went into town," Gideon said. "And Nevi's doing a trunk wash on Sira."
I looked at my daughter, fast asleep on the couch. I could have awakened her and taken her with me, but it had taken so long to get her to sleep, and Thomas, if he found out, would have been furious, as usual. Or I could have given Gideon 20 minutes of my time, tops, and returned before Jenna roused. I chose the latter, and it took only 15 minutes. That's how fast and how smoothly we worked in tandem. Our synchronicity made my heart hurt. I had so much I wanted to say to him. "Gideon," I said as we finished, "what can I do?" His gaze slid away.
"Do you miss her?"
"Yes," I whispered. "Of course I do." His nostrils flared, and his jaw seemed made of stone.
"That's why we can't do this anymore,"
he muttered. "I could not breathe. Because I'm sorry Grace is gone?" He shook his head.
"No,"
he said.
"Because I'm not."
His mouth contorted, twisted around a sob, and he fell to his knees. He buried his face against my stomach. I kissed the crown of Gideon's head and wrapped my arms around him. I held him so tightly that he could not fall apart. 10 minutes later, I raced back to the cottage on the ATV to find the front door was open. Maybe I had forgotten to close it in my haste. That's what I was thinking anyway, when I walked inside and realized Jenna was gone. "Thomas!" I yelled, racing outside again. "Thomas!" He had to have her. He had to have her. This was my prayer, my litany. I thought about the moment she had awakened and found me missing. Had she cried? Panicked? Gone to find me? I had been so sure I'd taught her about safety, that she was capable of learning, that Thomas was wrong about her getting hurt. But now I looked at the enclosures, at the gaps in the railing that a toddler could so easily crawl through. Jenna was 3 now. She knew her way. What if she'd wandered out the door and through the fencing? I radioed for Gideon, who came immediately when he heard the terror in my voice. "Check the barns," I begged. "Check the enclosures." I knew that these elephants had worked with humans in zoos and circuses, but that didn't mean they wouldn't charge someone who invaded their domain. I also knew that elephants preferred the lower voices of males. I always tried to make my voice huskier when I spoke to them. Since high-pitched voices are nervous voices, elephants associate female pitches with anxiety, and a child's voice would fall into that category. I knew a man once who owned property high up in the game reserve, who had gone bushwhacking with his 2 little girls and found himself surrounded by a wild elephant herd. He told his daughters to roll themselves up in a ball and be as small as possible. "No matter what happens," he said, "do not lift your head." 2 large females came forward to smell the girls and pushed against them a little, but they did not injure a hair on the head of either child. But I would not be there to tell Jenna to get into a tiny ball, and she would be fearless because she'd seen me interact with the elephants. I drove the ATV into the closest enclosure, the African one, because I did not think Jenna could have gotten too far. I raced past the barn and the pond and the high spot where the elephants sometimes went in the cool mornings. I stood at the top of the highest ridge and took out my binoculars and tried to spot movement as far as my eye could see. I spent 20 minutes driving around, tears in my eyes, wondering how I would explain to Thomas that our daughter was missing. And then Gideon's voice crackled on the radio.
"I've got her," he said.
He told me to meet him at the cottage, and there I found my baby on Nevi's lap, sucking on a popsicle, all sticky palms and cherry lips.
"Mama," Jenna said, holding it out to me. "Ice cream."
But I couldn't look at her. I was too busy focusing on Nevi, who seemed oblivious to the fact that I was so angry I was shaking. Nevi's hand rested on my daughter's head like a blessing.
"Someone woke up crying," she said. "Looking for you."
It was not an excuse. It was an explanation. If anything, I was the one to blame, because I had left my baby alone. Suddenly, I knew I wouldn't yell, and I wouldn't reprimand Nevi for taking my daughter away without asking me first. Jenna had needed a mother, and I hadn't been there. Nevi had needed a child so that she could still parent someone. At the time, it seemed a match made in heaven. The strangest behavior I have ever witnessed among elephants happened in the Tule block, on the bank of a dry riverbed during a prolonged drought in an area where many different animals passed. The night before, lions had been sighted. That morning there was a leopard on the bank above, but the predators had gone, and an elephant named Maria had given birth. It was a normal birth. The herd protected her during labor by facing outward. They trumpeted in ecstasy when the calf arrived, and Maria managed to get him up on his feet by balancing him against her leg. She dusted him and introduced him to the herd, each family member touching the baby and checking in. All of a sudden, an elephant named Tato began to walk up the length of the dry riverbed. Now, she was an acquaintance of this herd, but not a member of it. I have no idea what she was doing alone, away from the rest of her own family. As she came by the newborn calf, she wrapped her trunk around his neck and began to lift him. We see all the time how a mother might try to lift her newborn to get him moving by sliding her trunk beneath his belly or between his legs. But it is not normal to pick a calf up by the neck. No mother would do that intentionally. The little calf was slipping out of the grasp of Tato's trunk as she walked away. The more he slipped, the higher she lifted, trying to keep that baby in her grip. Finally, he fell, slamming hard to the ground. That was the catalyst that spurred the herd to action. There was rumbling and trumpeting and chaos, and the family members touched the newborn to make sure he was all right, to prove that in fact he had not been hurt. Maria gathered him close and pulled him between her legs. There was so much about this situation I did not understand. I'd seen elephants pick up babies when they were in the water to keep them from drowning. I'd seen elephants lift babies that were lying down to get them to stand on their feet. But I had never seen an elephant try to carry off a calf, like a lioness with a cub. I didn't know what made Tato think she could get away with kidnapping another's calf. I didn't know if that was her intent, or if she scented the lion and the leopard and felt he was in danger. I didn't know why the herd did not react when Tato tried to take the calf. She was older than Maria, for sure, but she was not a member of the family. We named that baby Malatal Hegi. In Tswana, it means the lost one. The night after I almost lost Jenna, I had a nightmare. In my dream, I was sitting near the spot where Malatal Hegi had nearly been taken by Tato. As I watched, the elephants moved to higher ground, and water began to trickle down the dry throat of the riverbed. The water gurgled, running deeper and faster until it splashed over my feet. On the far side of the river, I saw Grace Cartwright. She stepped into the water fully clothed. She reached down to the riverbed, picked up a smooth stone, and tucked it into her shirt. She did this over and over, filling her pants, her coat pockets, until she could barely bend and stand again. Then she began to walk deeper into the river's current. I knew how deep the water got and how quickly that could happen. I tried to yell to Grace, but I couldn't make a sound. When I opened my mouth, 1,000 stones poured out. And then suddenly, I was the one in the water, weighted down. I felt the current pull my hair free from its braid. I struggled for air. But with every breath, I was swallowing pebbles. agate and spiky calcite, basalt and slate and obsidian. I looked up at the watercolor sun as I sank. I woke up, panicking, Gideon's hand pressed against my mouth. Fighting him, I kicked and rolled until he was at one side of the bed and I was at the other, and there was a barricade between us of the words we should have said but didn't.
"You were screaming," he said. "You were going to wake the whole camp."
I realized that the first bloody streaks of dawn were in the sky, that I had fallen asleep when I only meant to steal a few moments. When Thomas woke an hour later, I was back in the living room of the cottage, sleeping on the couch, my arm flung over Jenna's tiny body as if nothing could possibly get past me to take her away, as if there was no way I would ever let her wake up and find me absent. He glanced at me, seemingly unconscious, and stumbled into the kitchen in search of coffee. Except I wasn't actually asleep when he passed by. I was thinking about how my nights had been dark and dreamless my whole life, except for one notable exception, when my imagination kicked into overdrive and every midnight hour was a pantomime of my greatest fears. The last time that happened, I'd been pregnant.
Jenna. My grandmother stares at me as if she's seeing a ghost. She grabs me tight, running her hands over my shoulders and my hair as if she needs to do an inventory. But there's a viciousness in her touch, too, as if she's trying to hurt me just as badly as I've hurt her.
Jenna, my God, where have you been?
I kind of wish I'd taken Serenity or Virgil up on their offer to drive me home, to smooth the path between my grandmother and me. Right now it's like Mount Kilimanjaro has sprung up between us. I'm sorry, I mutter. I had to do some stuff. I use Gertie as an excuse to break away from her. My dog starts licking my legs like there's no tomorrow, and when she jumps up on me, I bury my face in the rough at her neck.
I thought you would run away,
my grandmother says.
I thought maybe you were doing drugs, drinking. There are stories on the news all the time about girls who get kidnapped. Good girls who make the mistake of telling a stranger what time it is when they ask. I'm so worried, Jenna.
My grandmother is still wearing her meter maid uniform, but I can see that her eyes are red and her skin is too pale, like she hasn't slept.
I called everyone. Mr. Allen, who told me that you haven't been babysitting for his son because his wife and baby are visiting her mother in California. The school, your friends.
Horrified, I stare at her. Who the hell did she call? Short of Chatham, who doesn't even live here anymore, there's no one I hang around with. Which means my grandmother contacting a random kid to find out if I'm at her house having a sleepover is even more humiliating. I don't think I can go back to school in the fall. I don't know if I can go back in the next 20 years. I'm mortified. And I'm mad at her, because it's hard enough to be a loser whose mother's dead and whose father killed her in a fit of crazy without becoming the laughingstock of the 8th grade. I push Gertie away from me. Did you call the police, too? I ask. Or is that still a sticking point for you? My grandmother's hand comes up as if she's going to hit me. I cringe. This would be the second time this week I've been hit by someone who's supposed to love me. But my grandmother never touches me. She has raised her hand to point upstairs.
Go to your room,
she tells me.
And don't come out until I say you can.
Because it's been 2.5 days since I last showered, the bathroom is my first stop. I run the water in the tub so hot that a curtain of steam fills the tiny room, and the mirrors fog up so that I don't have to look at myself as I strip off my clothes. Then I sit in the tub, my knees pulled up to my chest, and let the water keep running until it is almost level with the edge. Taking a huge breath, I slide down the slope of the tub so that I am lying on the very bottom. I cross my arms coffin style and open my eyes as wide as I can. The shower curtain, pink with white flowers, looks like a kaleidoscope. There are bubbles that escape from my nose periodically, like little kamikaze warriors. My hair fans around my face like seaweed. And this is how I found her, I imagine my grandmother saying.
Like she'd just fallen asleep underneath the water.
I picture Serenity sitting with Virgil at my funeral, saying that I look so peaceful. I figure Virgil might even go home afterward and tip a glass, or six, in my honor. It's getting harder to not burst upright. The pressure on my chest is so strong I have a quick flash of my ribs snapping, my chest caving in, my eyes have stars dancing in front of them, underwater fireworks. In the minutes before it happened, was this how my mother felt? I know she did not drown, but her chest was crushed. I've read the autopsy report. Her skull was cracked. Was she struck in the head before that? Did she see the blow coming? Did time slow down and sound move in waves of color? Could she feel the motion of blood cells at the thin skin of her wrists? I just want, once, to share something she felt, even if it's the last thing I feel. When I am certain that I am going to implode, that it is time to let the water rush into my nostrils and fill me so I sink like a stricken ship, my hands grab the lip of the tub and haul the rest of me into the air. I gasp, and then I cough so violently that there is blood in the water. My hair mats my face, and my shoulders convulse. I lean over the side of the tub, chest pressed against the porcelain, and I vomit into the trash can. Suddenly, I remember being in a tub when I was tiny, when I could barely sit up by myself without toppling over like an egg. My mother would sit behind me, propping me in the V of her body. She would soap herself, and then soap me. I slipped like a minnow through her hands. Sometimes she sang. Sometimes she read journal articles. I sat in the circle of her legs, playing with rubber cups in a rainbow of colors, filling them, dumping them over my head and her knees. I realized then that I've already felt something my mother felt. Love. What do you think it was like for Captain Ahab in the seconds before that harpoon line wrenched him out of the boat? Did he say to himself, "Well, bummer, but that damn whale was worth it"? When Javert finally realized that Valjean had something he himself didn't, mercy, did he shrug and find a new obsession like knitting or Game of Thrones? No, because without Valjean to hate, he didn't know who he was anymore. I've spent years looking for my mom, and now all signs are starting to point to the fact that I couldn't have found her if I'd crawled every inch of this earth. Because she left it 10 years ago. Dead is so final. So done. But I'm not crying like I thought I would. Not anymore. And there's the tiniest green shoot of relief breaking through the wasteland of my thoughts. She did not willingly leave me behind. Then there's the fact that the person who killed her is most likely my own father. I don't know why this is less of a shock to me. Maybe because I don't remember my father at all. He was already gone when I knew him, living in a world his own brain had created. And since I'd already lost him once, I don't feel like I'm losing him again. My mom, though? That's different. I had wanted. I had hoped. Virgil is all about crossing the T's and dotting the I's, because so much has been screwed up in this investigation already. He said that tomorrow he'll figure out a way to test the DNA of the body that everyone thought was Nevi's, because then we will all know. The funny thing is that now that this moment is here, the one I've pegged as my high watermark for years, does it matter? Here's the thing. I may finally have the truth. I may have closure, which is what the school counselor was always talking about with me when she corralled me in her stupid office. But here's something I don't have. My mother. I start to read.